Side 6. A Fire Upon the Deep by Werner Vinge. Continuing on page 120. Von Neuen made a coughing laugh.
Oh, it's conventional enough, but very clever. A few grams of replicant disorder wafted in over weeks. It's blossoming now, timed with the attack, you see. The growth will die in a matter of hours after it kills all of Relay's precious high automation. Ravna, take the ship or die in the next 1,000 seconds. Take the ship. If you survive, go to the bottom. Get the...
The emissary device gagged on the end of the sentence. It pulled itself straighter and smiled its greenish smile a last time.
And here is my gift to you. The best help I have left to give.
The smile disappeared. The glassy look was replaced by a wonder, and then mounting terror. Von Neuen dragged in a great breath and had time for one barking scream before he collapsed. He landed face down, twitching and choking in the sand. Ravna shouted Gronder's code again and ran to Von Neuen. She pulled him over on his back and tried to clear his mouth. The fit lasted several seconds, Fom's limbs flailing randomly about. Ravna collected solid hits as she tried to steady him. Then Fom went limp, and she could barely feel his breath.
Blueshell was saying, "Somehow he's grabbed the OOB. It's 4,000 kilometers out, coming straight for the docks. Whale, we're ruined."
Unauthorized flight close to the docks was cause for confiscation. Somehow Ravna didn't think it mattered anymore.
"Is there any sign of attack?" she said over her shoulder.
She eased Fom's head back, made sure he had a clear breathing passage. Random rustling between the scrotoriders. Greenstalk,
"Something is strange. We have service suspension on the main transceivers."
"So Old One is still transmitting?"
"The local net is very clogged. Much automation, many employees being called to special duty."
Ravna rocked back. The sky was night dark, punctuated by a dozen bright points of light, ships guiding for the docks. All very normal, but her own data set was showing what Greenstalk reported.
"Ravna, I can't talk right now."
Gronder's clickety voice sounded out of the air beside her. This would be his associate program.
"Old One has taken most of Relay. Watch out for the emissary device."
A little late, that.
"We've lost contact with the surveillance fence beyond the transceivers. We are having program and hardware failures. Old One claims we are being attacked."
A 5-second pause.
"We see evidence of fleet action at the domestic defense boundary."
That was just a half light year out.
"Brap," from Blueshell. "At the domestic defense boundary. How could you miss them coming in?"
He rolled back and forth, pivoted. Gronder's associate ignored the question.
"Minimum 3,000 ships. Destruction of transceivers imminent." "Ravna, are the scrotoriders with you?"
It was still Gronder's voice, but more staccato, more involved. This was the real guy.
Yes.
"The local network is failing. Life support failing. The docks will fall. We would be stronger than the attacking fleet, but we're rotting from the inside. Relay is dying."
His voice sharpened, clattering.
"But Vreeny Me will not die, and a contract is a contract. Tell the riders we will pay them, somehow, someday. We require, plead, they fly the mission we contracted. Ravna?"
"Yes, they hear."
"Then go."
And the voice was gone.
Blueshell said,
"OOB will be here in 200 seconds.
Von Neuen had calmed, and his breathing was easier. As the two riders chittered back and forth, Ravna looked around and suddenly realized that all the death and destruction had been reports from afar. The beach and the sky were almost as placid as ever. The last of the sun's rays had left the waves. The foam was a dim band in the low green light. Here and there, yellow lights glowed in the trees and the farther towers. Yet the alarm had clearly spread. She could hear data sets coming on. Some of the beach fires guttered out, and the figures around them ran into the trees or drifted upwards, headed for farther offices.
Now starships floated up from their berths across the sea, falling higher and higher till they glittered in the departed sunlight. It was Relay's last moment of peace. A patch of glowing dark spread across the sky. She gasped at light so twisted it should have gone unseen. It shone more in the back of her head than in her eyes. Afterwards, she couldn't think what made it objectively different from blackness.
"There's another," said Blue Shell.
This one was near the dock's horizon, a blot of darkness perhaps a degree across. The edges were an indistinct bleeding of black into black.
"What is it?"
Rothna was no war freak, but she'd read her share of adventure stories. She knew about antimatter bombs and relativistic kinetic energy slugs. From a distance, such weapons were bright spots of light, sometimes an orchestrated flickering. Or closer, a world wrecker would glow incandescent across the curve of a planet, splashing the globe itself like a drop of water, but slow, slow. Those were the images her reading had prepared her for. What she saw now was more like a defect in her eyesight than a vision of war. Powers only knew what the Scroderiders saw, but...
"Your main transceivers. Vaping out, I think," said Blue Shell.
"Those are light years out. There's no way we could see..."
Another splotch appeared, not even in her field of view. The color floated, placeless. Pom Nguyen spasmed again, but weakly. She had no trouble holding him still, but blood dribbled from his mouth. The back of his shirt was wet with something that stank of decay.
"OOB will be here in 100 seconds. Plenty of time. There's plenty of time."
Blue Shell rolled back and forth around them, talking reassurance that just showed how nervous he was.
"Yes, my lady, light years out, and years from now the flash of their going will light the sky for anyone still alive here. But only a fraction of the vape out is making light. The rest is an ultra-wave surge so great that ordinary matter is affected, optic nerves tickled by the overflow. So much that your own nervous system becomes a receiver."
He spun around.
"But don't worry, we're tough and quick. We've squeezed through close spots before."
There was something absurd about a creature with no short-term memory bragging up its lightning cleverness. She hoped his scroto was up to this. Greenstalk's voice buzzed painfully loud.
"Look!"
The surfline was drawing back further than she had ever seen it.
"The sea is falling," shouted Greenstalk.
Water's edge had pulled back 100 meters, 200. The green-limbed horizon was dipping.
"Ships still 50 seconds out. We'll fly to meet it. Come, Ravna."
Ravna's own courage died cold that second. Gronder had said the docks would fall. The near sky was crowded now as dozens of people raced for safety. 100 meters away, the sand itself was shifting, an avalanche tilting toward the abyss. She remembered something Old One had said, and suddenly she knew the flyers were making a terrible mistake. The thought cut through her terror.
"No, just head for higher ground."
The night was silent no more. A bell-like moaning came from the sea. The sound spread. The sunset breeze grew to a gale that twisted the trees toward the water, sending branches and sand sweeping past them. Ravna was still on her knees, her hands pressing down on Fom's limp arms. No breath, no pulse. The eye stared sightlessly. Old One's gift to her. Damn all the powers. She grabbed Pom Nguyen under the shoulders and rolled him onto her back. She gagged, almost lost her grip. Underneath her shirt, she felt cavities where there should be solid flesh. Something wet and rank dripped around her sides. She struggled up from her knees, half carrying and half dragging the body.
Blue Shell was shouting, "Take hours to roll anywhere."
He drifted off the ground, driving his agrav against the wind. Scroda and Ryder twisted drunkenly for an instant, and then he was slammed back to the ground, tumbled willy-nilly toward the wind's destination, the moaning hole that had been the sea. Greenstalk raced to his seaward side, blocking his progress toward destruction. Blue Shell righted himself, and the two rolled back toward Ravna. The rider's voice was faint in the wind.
"Agrav, failing!"
And with it the very structure of the docks. They walked and wheeled their way back from the sucking sea.
Find a place to land the OOB.
The tree line was a jagged range of hills now. The landscape changed before their eyes and under her feet. The groaning sound was everywhere, some places so loud it buzzed through Ravna's shoes. They avoided the sagging terrain, the sinkholes that opened on all sides. The night was dark no more. Whether it was emergency lighting or a side effect of the agrav failure, blue glowed around the holes. Through those holes, they saw the cloud-decked night of groundside 1,000 kilometers below. The space between was not empty. There were shimmering phantoms, billions of tons of water and earth, and hundreds of dying flyers. Vrini Meorg was paying the price for building their docks on a grav instead of inertial orbit. Somehow the three were making progress. Von Neuen was almost too heavy to carry drag. She staggered left and right almost as much as she moved forward. Yet he was lighter than she would have guessed, and that was terrifying in its own way. Was even the high ground failing? Most of the agravs died by failure, but some suffered destructive runaway. Clumps of trees and earth ripped free from the tops of hillocks and accelerated upwards. The wind shifted back and forth, up and down, but it was thinner now, the noise remote. The artificial atmosphere that clothed the docks would soon be gone. Ravna's pocket pressure suit worked for a few minutes, but now it was fading. In a few minutes it would be as dead as her agravs, as dead as she would be. She wondered vaguely how the Blight had managed this. Like the old one, she would likely die without ever knowing. She saw torch flares. There were ships. Most had boosted for inertial orbits or gone directly into ultra-drive, but a few hung over the disintegrating landscape. Blueshell and Greenstalk led the way. The two used their third axles in ways Ravna had never guessed at, lifting and pushing to clamber up slopes that she could scarcely negotiate with Fom's weight dragging from her back. They were on a hilltop, but not for long. This had been part of the office forest. Now the trees stuck out in different directions, like hair on a mangy dog. She felt the ground throbbing beneath her feet. What next? The Schroederiders rolled from one side of the peak to another. They would be rescued here or nowhere. She went to her knees, resting most of Fom's weight on the ground. From here you could see a long ways. The docks looked like a slowly flapping flag, and every immense whip of the fabric broke fragments loose. As long as some consensus remained among the agrav units, it still had plainer aspect. That was disappearing. There were sinkholes all around their little knob of forest. On the horizon, Ravna saw the far edge of the docks detach itself and turn slowly sideways. 100 kilometers long, 10 wide, it swept down on would-be rescue ships. Blueshell brushed against her left side, Greenstalk against her right. Ravna twisted, laying some of Fom's weight on the Skrota hulls. If all four merged their pressure suits, there would be a few more moments of consciousness.
"The OOB, I'm flying it down," he said.
Something was coming down. A ship's torch lit the ground blue-white with shadows stark and shifting. It's not a healthy thing to be around a rocket drive hovering in a near 1G field. An hour earlier, the maneuver would have been impossible, or a capital offense if accomplished. Now it didn't matter if the torch punched through the docks or fried a cargo from halfway across the galaxy. Still, where could Blueshell land the thing? They were surrounded by sinkholes and moving cliffs. She closed her eyes as the burning light drifted down before them, and then dimmed. Blueshell's shot was thin in their shared atmosphere.
"Let's go together."
She held tight to the riders, and they crawled, wheeled, down from their little hill. The out-of-band two was hovering in the middle of a sinkhole. Its torch was hidden from view, but the glare off the sides of the hole put the ship in sharp silhouette, turned its ultra-drive spines into feathery white arcs. A giant moth with glowing wings, and just out of reach. If their suits held, they could make it to the edge of the hole. Then what? The spines kept the ship from getting closer than 100 meters. an able-bodied and crazy human might try to grab a spine and crawl down it. But Schroederiders had their own brand of insanity. Just as the light, the reflected light, became too much to bear, the torch winked out. The OOB fell through the hole. This didn't stop the rider's advance.
"Faster," said Blueshell.
And now she guessed what they planned. Quickly, for such an awkward jumble of limbs and wheels, they moved up to the edge of the darkened hole. Ravna felt the dirt giving way beneath her feet, and then they were falling. The docks were hundreds, in places thousands, of meters thick. They fell past them now, past dim, eerie flickers of internal destruction. Then they were through, still falling. For a moment, the feeling of wild panic was gone. After all, this was simply free fall, a commonplace, and a damn sight more peaceful than the disintegrating docks. Now it was easy to hold on to the riders and Fom Nguyen, and even their commensal atmosphere seemed a little thicker than before. There was something to be said for hard vacuum and freefall. Except for an occasional rogue a grav, everything was coming down at the same acceleration, ruins peacefully settling. And 4 or 5 minutes from now, they would hit groundside's atmosphere, still falling almost straight downwards. Entry velocity only 3 or 4 kilometers per second. Would they burn up? Maybe. Flashes pricked bright above the cloud decks. The junk around them was mostly dark, just shadows against the sky show above. But the shape directly below was large and regular. The OOB. Bow on. The ship was falling with them. Every few seconds, a trim jet fired, a faint reddish glow. The ship was closing with them. If it had a nose hatch, they would land right on it. Its docking lights flicked on, bright upon them. 10 meters separation. 5. There was a hatch, and open. She could see a very ordinary airlock within. Whatever hit them was big. Ravna saw a vague expanse of plastic rising over her shoulder. The rogue was slowly turning, and it scarcely brushed them, but that was enough. Fom Nguyen was jarred from her grasp. His body was lost in shadow, then suddenly lit bright as the ship's spotlight tracked after him. Simultaneously, the air gusted out of Ravna's lungs. They were down to 3 pocket pressure fields now, failing fields. It was not enough. Ravna could feel consciousness slipping away, her vision tunneling. So close. The riders unlatched from each other. She grabbed at the scrota hulls, and they drifted, strung out, over the ship's lock. Blueshell's scrota jerked against her as the he made fast to the hatch. The jolt twisted her around, whipping greenstalk upwards. Things were getting dreamy now. Where was panic when you needed it? "Hold tight, hold tight, hold tight," sang the little voice, all that was left of consciousness. Bump. Jerk. The riders pushed and pulled at her. Or maybe it was the ship jerking all of them around. They were puppets, dancing off a single string. Deep in the tunnel of her vision, a rider grabbed at the tumbling figure of Fom Nguyen. Ravna wasn't aware of losing consciousness, but the next she knew she was breathing air and choking on vomit, and was inside the airlock. Solid green walls closed in comfortingly on all sides. Fom Nguyen lay on the far wall, strapped into a first aid canister. His face had a bluish cast. She pushed awkwardly across the lock toward Fom Nguyen's wall. The place was a confused jumble, unlike the passenger and sporting ships she'd been on before. Besides, this was a rider design. Stickum patches were scattered around the walls. Greenstalk had mounted her scrota on one cluster. They were accelerating, maybe a 20th of a G.
"We're still going down?" "Yes. If we hover or rise, we'll crash."
"Into all the junk that still rains from above."
"Blueshell is trying to fly us out."
They were falling with the rest, but trying to drift out from under before they hit groundside. There was an occasional rattle-ping against the hull. Sometimes the acceleration ceased or shifted in a new direction. Blueshell was actively avoiding the big pieces.
not with complete success. There was a long rasping sound that ended with a bang, and the room turned slowly around her.
"Brap, just lost an ultra-drive spine," came Blue Shell's voice. "Two others already damaged. Please strap down, my lady."
They touched atmosphere 100 seconds later. The sound was a barely perceptible humming beyond the hull. It was the sound of death for a ship like this. It could no more arrow break than a dog could jump over the moon. The noise came louder. Blue Shell was actually diving, trying to get deep enough to shed the junk that surrounded the ship. Two more spines broke. Then came a long surge of main axis acceleration. Out of band two, arced out of the dock's death shadow, drove out and out into inertial orbit. Ravna looked over Blue Shell's fronds at the outside windows. They had just passed Groundside's Terminator and were flying an inertial orbit. They were in freefall again, but this trajectory curved back on itself without whacking into big hard things like Groundside. Ravna didn't know much more about space travel than you'd expect of a frequent passenger and an adventure fan, but it was obvious that Blue Shell had pulled off a near miracle. When she tried to thank him, the rider rolled back and forth across the stick patches, buzzing faintly to himself. Embarrassed, or just riderly inattentive? Greenstalk spoke, sounding a little shy, a little proud.
"Far trading is our life, you know. If we are cautious, life will be mostly safe and placid, but there will be close passages. Blue Shell practices all the time, programming his scrota with every wit he can imagine. He is a master."
In everyday life, indecision seemed to dominate the riders. But in a crunch, they didn't hesitate to bet everything. She wondered how much of that was the scrota overriding its rider.
"Grump," said Blue Shell, "I have simply postponed the close passage. I broke several of our drive spines. What if they do not self-repair? What do we do then? Everything around Groundside is destroyed. There is junk everywhere out to 100 radii. Not dense like around the docks, but of much higher velocity.
You can't inject billions of tons of wreckage into buckshot orbits and expect safe navigation.
And any second, the perversion's creatures will be here, eating whoever survives."
"Erk!"
Greenstalk's tendrils froze in comical disarray. She chittered to herself for a second.
"You're right. I forgot. I thought we had found an open space, but..."
"Open space, all right, but in a shooting gallery." Ravna looked back at the command deck windows. They were on the day side now, perhaps 500 kilometers above Groundside's principal ocean. The space above the hazy blue horizon was free of flashing glow.
"I don't see any fighting," Ravna said hopefully.
"Sorry."
Blue Shell switched the windows to a more significant view. Most of it was navigation and ultra-trace information, meaningless to Ravna. Her eye caught on a med stat. Von Neuen was breathing again. The ship's surgeon thought it could save him. But there was also a communication status window. On it, the attack was dreadfully clear. The local net had broken into hundreds of screaming fragments. There were only automatic voices from the planetary surface, and they were calling for medical aid. Gronder had been down there. Somehow she suspected that not even his marketing ops people had survived. Whatever hit Groundside was even deadlier than the failures at the docks. In near-planetary space, there were a few survivors and ships and fragments of habitats, most on doomed trajectories. Without massive and coordinated help, they would be dead in minutes, hours at the outside. The directors of Vrinimi Org were gone, destroyed before they ever figured out quite what had happened.
"Go," Gronder had said. "Go."
Out-system, there was fighting. Ravna saw message traffic from Vrinimi defense units. Even without control or coordination, some still opposed the perversion's fleet. The light from their battles would arrive well after the defeat, well after the enemy arrived here in person. "How long do we have? Minutes?
Brap. Look at those traces, said Blue Shell. The perversion is almost 4,000 vessels. They are bypassing the defenders.
But now there is scarcely anyone left out there, said Greenstalk. I hope they're not all dead.
Not all. I see several thousand ships departing, everyone with the means and any sense.
Blue Shell rolled back and forth.
Alas, we have the good sense, but look at this repair report.
One window spread large, filled with colored patterns that meant less than zip to Ravna.
Two spines still broken, unrepairable. Three partially repaired. If they don't heal, we'll be stuck here.
This is unacceptable. His voter voice buzzed up shrilly. Greenstalk drove close to him, and they rattled their fronds at each other. Several minutes passed. When Blue Shell spoke Somnorsh again, his voice was quieter.
One spine repaired. Maybe, maybe, maybe.
He opened a natural view. The OOB was coasting across Groundside's South Pole, back into night. Their orbit should take them over the worst of the dock's junk, but the ride was a constant jigging as the ship avoided other debris. The cries of battle horror from out-system dwindled. The Vrinimi organization was one vast, twitching corpse, and very soon its killer would come snuffling.
Two repaired. Blue Shell became very quiet. Three. Three are repaired. 15 seconds to recalibrate, and we can jump.
It seemed longer. But then all the windows changed to a natural view. Groundside and its sun were gone. Stars and dark stretched all around. 3 hours later, and Relay was 150 light-years behind them. The OOB was in with the main body of fleeing ships. What with the archives and the tourism, there had been an extraordinary number of interstellar ships at Relay. 10,000 vehicles were spread across the light-years around them. But stars were rare this far off the galactic plane, and they were at least 100 hours flying time from the nearest refuge. For Ravna, it was the start of a new battle. She glared across the deck at Blue Shell. The scrotum rider dithered, its fronds twisting on themselves in a way she had not seen before.
See here, my Lady Bergshendat. High Point is a lovely civilization with some bipedal participants. It is safe. It is nearby. You could adapt.
He paused. Reading my expression, is he?
But if that is not acceptable, we will take you further. Give us a chance to contract the proper cargo, and we'll take you all the way back to Chandra K. How about that?
No. You already have a contract, Blue Shell, with Vrinimi Organization. The three of us,
and whatever has become of Fom Nuin,
are going to the bottom of the Beyond.
I am shaking my head in disbelief. We received a preliminary retainer, true. But now that Vrinimi Org is dead, there is no one to make good on the rest of the agreement. Hence, we are free of it also.
Vrinimi is not dead. You heard Grandir Kalir. The Org has branch offices all across the Beyond. The obligation stands.
On a technicality, we both know that those branches could never make the final payment.
Ravna didn't have a good answer to that.
You have an obligation, she said, but without the proper forcefulness. She had never been good at bluster.
My lady, are you truly speaking from org ethics or from simple humanity?
In fact, Ravna had never completely understood org ethics. That was one reason why she had intended to return to Chandra K after her apprenticeship, and one reason the org had dealt cautiously with the human race.
It doesn't matter which I speak from. There is a contract. You were happy to honor it when things looked safe. Well, things turned deadly. But that possibility was part of the deal.
Ravna glanced at Greenstalk. She had been silent so far, not even rustling at her mate. Her fronds were tightly held against her central stalk. Maybe.
Listen, there are other reasons besides contract obligation. The perversion is more powerful than anyone thought. It killed a power today, and it's operating in the middle beyond. The Riders have a long history, Blue Shell, longer than most races' entire existence. The perversion may be strong enough to put an end to all of that.
Greenstalk rolled toward her and opened slightly.
You really think we might find something on that ship at the bottom? Something that could harm a power among powers?
Ravna paused.
Yes, and Old One himself thought so, just before he died.
Blue Shell wrapped even tighter around himself, twisting. In anguish?
My lady, we are traitors. We have lived long and traveled far, and survived by minding our own business. No matter what romantics may think, traitors do not go on quests. What you ask is impossible, mere beyonders seeking to subvert a power.
Yet that was a risk you signed for. But Ravna didn't say it aloud. Perhaps Greenstalk did. Her fronds rustled and Blue Shell scrunched even more. Greenstalk was silent for a second, then she did something funny with her axles, bumping free of the stickum. Her wheels spun on nothing as she floated through a slow arc till she was upside down, her fronds reaching down to brush Blue Shell's. They rattled back and forth for almost 5 minutes. Blue Shell slowly untwisted, the fronds relaxing and patting back at his mate. Finally, he said,
"Very well. One quest, but mark you, never another."
Part 2. Chapter 17. Spring came wet and cold and excruciatingly slow. It had been raining the last 8 days. How Johanna wished for something else, even the dark of winter, back again. She slogged across mud that had been moss. It was midday. The gloomy light would last another 3 hours. Scarbutt claimed that without the overcast, they would be seeing a bit of direct sunlight nowadays. Sometimes she wondered if she would ever see the sun again. The castle's great yard was on a hillside. Mud and sullen snow spread down the hill, piled against the wooden buildings. Last summer there had been a glorious view from here, and in the winter the aurora had spilled green and blue across the snow, glinted on the frozen harbor, and outlined the far hills against the sky. Now, the rain was a close mist. She couldn't even see the city beyond the walls. The clouds were a low and ragged ceiling above her head. She knew there were guards on the stone walls of the castle curtain, but today they must be huddled behind watch slits. Not a single animal, not a single pack was visible. The Tyne's world was an empty place compared to Straum, but not like the High Lab either. High Lab was an airless rock orbiting a red dwarf. The Tyne's world was alive, moving. Sometimes it looked as beautiful and friendly as a holiday resort on Straum. Indeed, Johanna realized that it was kindlier than most worlds the human race had settled. Certainly a gentler world than New Yora, and perhaps as nice as old Earth. Johanna had reached her bungalow. She paused for a second under its outcurving walls and looked across the courtyard. Yes, it looked a little like medieval New Yora. But the stories from the Age of Princesses hadn't conveyed the implacable power in such a world. The rain went on for as far as she could see. Without decent technology, even a cold rain could be a deadly thing. So could the wind, and the sea was not something for an afternoon's fun sailing. She thought of surging hillocks of coldness, puckered with rain, going on and on. Even the forests around the town were threatening. It was easy to wander into them, but there were no radio finders, no refresh stalls disguised as tree trunks. Once lost, you would simply die. New Yoran fairy tales had a special meaning for her now. No great imagination was needed to invent the elementals of wind and rain and sea. This was the pre-tech experience, that even if you had no enemies, the world itself could kill you. And she did have plenty of enemies. Johanna pulled open the tiny door and went inside.
A pack of tines was sitting around the fire. It scrambled to its feet and helped Johanna out of her rain jacket. She didn't shrink from the fine-toothed muzzles anymore. This was one of her usual helpers. She could almost think of the jaws as hands, deftly pulling the oilskin jacket down her arms and hanging it near the fire. Johanna chucked her boots and pants and accepted the quilted wrap that the pack handed her.
"Dinner, now," she said to the pack.
"Okay."
Johanna settled on a pillow by the fire pit. In fact, the tines were more primitive than the humans on New Yora. The tines' world was not a fallen colony. They didn't even have legend to guide them. Sanitation was a sometime thing. Before Woodcarver, Tynish doctors bled their patients' victims. She knew now that she was living in the tines' equivalent of a luxury apartment. The deep-polished wood was not a normal thing. The designs painted on the pillars and walls were the result of many hours' labor. Johanna rested her chin on her hands and stared into the flames. She was vaguely aware of the pack prancing around the pit, hanging pots over the fire. This one spoke very little Somnorsh. It wasn't in on Woodcarver's dataset project. Many weeks ago, Scarbutt had asked to move in here. What better way to speed the learning process? Johanna shivered at the memory. She knew the scarred one was just a single member, that the pack that killed Dad had itself died. Johanna understood, but every time she saw Peregrine, she saw her father's murderer sitting fat and happy, thinking to hide itself behind its three smaller fellows. Johanna smiled into the flames, remembering the whack she had landed on Scarbutt when he made the suggestion. She'd lost control, but it had been worth it. No one else suggested that friends should share this house with her. Most evenings they left her alone. And some nights, Dad and Mom seemed so near, maybe just outside, waiting for her to notice. Even though she had seen them die, something inside her refused to let them go. Cooking smells slipped past the familiar daydream. Tonight it was meat and beans with something like onions. Surprise! The stuff smelled good. If there had been any variety, she would have enjoyed it. But Johanna hadn't seen fresh fruit in 60 days. Salted meat and veggies were the only winter fare. If Jeffrey were here, he'd throw a fit. It was months past that the word came from Woodcarver's spies up north. Jeffrey had died in the ambush. Johanna was getting over it. She really was. And in some ways, being all alone made things simpler. The pack put a plate of meat and beans before her, along with a kind of knife. Oh, well. Johanna grabbed the crooked hilt, bent sideways to be held by tinish jaws, and dug in. She was almost finished when there was a polite scratching at the door. Her servant gobbled something. The visitor replied, then said in rather good Somnorsh, and a voice that was eerily like her own,
"Hello there. My name is Scriber. I would like a small talk, okay?"
One of the servants turned to look at her. The rest were watching the door. Scriber was the one she thought of as Pompous Clown. He'd been with Scarbutt at the ambush, but he was such a fool that she scarcely felt threatened by him.
"Okay,"
she said, starting toward the door. Her servant, Guard, grabbed crossbows in its jaws, and all five members snaked up the staircase to the loft. There wasn't space for more than one pack down here. The cold and wet blew into the room along with her visitor. Johanna retreated to the other side of the fire while Scriber took off his rain slickers. The pack members shook themselves the way dogs do, a noisy, amusing sight, and you didn't want to be near when it happened. Finally, Scriber sauntered over to the fire pit. Under the slickers, he wore jackets with the usual stirrups and the open spaces behind the shoulders and at the haunches. But Scriber's appeared to be padded above the shoulders to make his members look heavier than they really were. One of him sniffed at her plate while the other heads looked this way and that, but never directly at her. Johanna looked down at the pack. She still had trouble talking to more than one face. Usually she picked on whichever was looking back at her.
"Well?"
What did you come to talk about?
One of the heads finally looked at her. It licked its lips.
Okay. Yes. I thought to see how do you do. I mean,
gobble. Her servant answered from upstairs, probably reporting what kind of mood she was in. Scriber straightened up. Four of his six heads looked at Johanna. His other two members paced back and forth as if contemplating something important.
Look here. You are the only human I know, but I have always been a big student of character. I know you are not happy here.
Papa's clown was also master of the obvious.
And I understand. But we do the best to help you. We are not the bad people who killed your parents and brother.
Johanna put a hand on the low ceiling and leaned forward. You're all thugs. You just happen to have the same enemies I do.
I know that, and I am cooperating. You'd still be playing the data set's Kinder mode if it weren't for me. I've shown you the reading courses. If you guys have any brains, you'll have gunpowder by summer.
The Oliphant was an heirloom toy, a huggable favorite thing she should have outgrown years ago. But there was history in it, stories of the queens and princesses of the Dark Ages, and how they had struggled to triumph over the jungles, to rebuild the cities and then the spaceships. Half hidden on obscure reference paths, there were also hard numbers, the history of technology. Gunpowder was one of the easiest things. When the weather cleared up, there would be some prospecting expeditions. Woodcarver had known about sulfur, but didn't have quantities in town. Making cannon would be harder. But then...
Then your enemies will be killed. Your people are getting what they want from me. So what's your complaint?
Complaint? Papa's clown's heads bobbed up and down in alternation. Such distributed gestures seemed to be the equivalent of facial expressions, though Johanna hadn't figured many of them out. This one might mean embarrassment.
I have no complaint. You are helping us, I know. But...
Three of his members were pacing around now.
It's just that I see more than most people, perhaps a little like Woodcarver did in olden days. I am a... I've seen your word for it. A dilettante. You know, a person who studies all things and who is talented at everything. I am only 30 years old, but I have read almost every book in the world and...
The heads bowed, perhaps in shyness.
I'm even planning to write one, perhaps the true story of your adventure.
Johanna found herself smiling. Most often she saw the Tynes as barbarian strangers, inhuman in spirit as well as form. But if she closed her eyes, she could almost imagine that Scriber was a fellow Straumer. Mom had a few friends just as brainless and innocently self-convinced as this one, men and women with 100 grandiose projects that would never, ever amount to anything. Back on Straum, they had been boring perils that she avoided. Now, well, Scriber's foolishness was almost like being back home again.
You're here to study me for your book?
More alternating nods.
Well, yes. And also, I wanted to talk to you about my other plans. I've always been something of an inventor, you see. I know that doesn't mean much now. It seems that everything that can be invented is already in Dataset. I've seen many of my best ideas there.
He sighed, or made the sound of a sigh. Now he was imitating one of the pop science voices in the Dataset. Sound was the easiest thing for the Tynes. It could be darn confusing.
In any case, I was just wondering how to improve some of those ideas.
Four of Scriber's members bellied down on the bench by the fire pit. It looked like he was settling in for a long conversation. His other two walked around the pit to give her a stack of paper threaded with brass hoops. While one on the other side of the fire continued to talk, the two carefully turned the pages and pointed at where she should look. Well, he did have plenty of ideas. Tethered birds to hoist flying boats. Giant lenses that would concentrate the sun's light on enemies and set them afire. From some of the pictures, it appeared he thought the atmosphere extended beyond the moon. Scriber explained each idea in numbing detail, pointing at the drawings and patting her hands enthusiastically. So you see the possibilities? My unique slant combined with the proven inventions and data set.
Who knows where it could lead?
Johanna giggled, overcome by the vision of Scriber's giant birds hauling kilometer-wide lenses to the moon. He seemed to take the sound for approval.
Yes. It's brilliant, okay? My latest idea, I never would have thought it except for data set. This radio, it projects sound very far and fast, okay? Why not combine it with the power of our tinish thoughts? A pack could think as one even spread across hundreds of, kilometers.
Now, that almost made sense. But if gunpowder took months to make, even given the exact formula, how many decades would it be before the packs had radio?
Scriber was an immense fountain of half-baked ideas. She let his words wash over her for more than an hour. It was insanity, but less alien than most of what she had endured this last year. Finally, he seemed to run down. There were longer pauses, and he asked her opinion more often. Finally, he said,
"Well, that was certainly fun, okay?"
Yes, fascinating.
I knew you would like it. You're just like my people, I really think. You're not all angry, not all the time.
Just what do you mean by that?
Johanna pushed a soft muzzle away and stood. The dog thing rocked back on its haunches to look up at her.
You have much to hate, I know, but you seem so angry at us all the time, and we're the ones who are trying to help you. After the day work, you stay here. You don't want to talk with people. Though now I see that was our fault. You wanted us to come here, but we're too proud to say it. I have these insights into character, you see. My friend, the one you call Scarbutt, he is truly a nice fellow. I know I can tell you that honestly, and that is my new friend you will believe. He would very much like to come to visit you to... Erk.
Johanna walked slowly around the fire pit, forcing the two members to back away from her. All of Scriber was looking up at her now, the necks arching around one another, the eyes wide.
"I'm not like you. I don't need your talk or your stupid ideas."
She threw Scriber's notebook into the pit. Scriber leaped to the fire's edge, desperately reached for the burning notes. He pulled most of them back and clutched them to his chest. Johanna kept walking toward him, kicking at his legs. Scriber retreated, backing and sprawling.
"Stupid, dirty butchers! I'm not like you!"
She slapped her hand on a ceiling beam.
"Humans don't like to live like animals. We don't adopt killers. You tell Scarbutt. You tell him. If he ever comes by for a friendly chat, I'll smash in his head. I'll smash in all of them."
Scriber was backed into the wall now. His heads turned wildly this way and that. He was making plenty of noise. Some of it was somnorsh, but too high-pitched to understand. One of his mouths found the door pull. He pushed open the door, and all six members raced into the twilight, their rain-slickers forgotten. Johanna knelt and stuck her head through the doorway. The air was a wind-driven mist. In an instant, her face was so cold and wet that she couldn't feel the tears. Scriber was six shadows in the darkening grayness, shadows that raced down the hillside, sometimes tumbling in their haste. In a second, he was gone. There was nothing but the vague forms of nearby cabins and the yellow light that spilled out around her from the fire. Strange. Right after the ambush, she had felt terror. The Tynes had been unstoppable killers. Then, on the boat, when she smashed Scarbutt, it had been so wonderful. The whole pack collapsed, and suddenly she knew that she could fight back, that she could break their bones. She didn't have to be at their mercy. Tonight she had learned something more. Even without touching them, she could hurt them. Some of them, anyway. Her dislike alone had undone Pompa's clown. Johanna backed into the smoky warmth and shut the door. She should feel triumph. Chapter 18. Scriber Jacques Ramaphan didn't tell anyone about his meeting with the Two Legs. Of course, Vendacious's guard had overheard everything. The fellow might not speak much Somnorsh, but he had surely gotten the drift of the argument. People would hear about it eventually. He moped around the castle for a few days, spent a number of hours hunched over the remains of his notebook, trying to recreate the diagrams. It would be a while before he attended any more sessions with Dataset, especially when Johanna was around. Scriber knew he seemed brash to the outside world, but in fact it had taken a lot of courage to walk in on Johanna like that. He knew his ideas had genius, but all his life unimaginative people had been telling him otherwise. In most ways, Scriber was a very fortunate person. He had been born a fishing pack in Rangathir, at the eastern edge of the Republic. His parent had been a wealthy merchant. Jacques Ramafan had some of his parents' traits, but the dull patience necessary for day-to-day business work had been lost to him. His sibling pack more than retained that faculty. The family business grew, and, in the first years, his sib didn't begrudge Scriber his share of the wealth. From his earliest days, Scriber had been an intellectual. He read everything, natural history, biography, brood kenning. In the end, he had the largest library in Rangathir, more than 200 books. Even then, Scriber had tremendous ideas, insights, which, if properly executed, would have made them the wealthiest merchants in all the eastern provinces. Alas, bad luck and his sib's lack of imagination had doomed his early ideas. In the end, his sib bought out the business, and Jacques Ramafan moved to the capital. It was all for the best. By this time, Scriber had fleshed himself out to 6 members. He needed to see more of the world. Besides, there were 5,000 books in the library there, the experience of all history and all the world. His own notebooks became a library in themselves, yet still the packs at the university had no time for him. His outline for a summation of natural history was rejected by all the stationers, though he paid to have small parts of it published. It was clear that success in the world of action was necessary before his ideas could get the attention they deserved, hence his spy mission. Parliament itself would thank him when he returned with the secrets of Flenser's hidden island. That was almost a year ago. What had happened since, with the flying house and Johanna and Dataset, went beyond his wildest dreams, and Scriber granted that those dreams were already pretty extreme. The library and Dataset contained millions of books. With Johanna to help him polish his ideas, they would sweep Flenserism from the face of the world. They would regain her flying house. Not even the sky would be a limit. So to have her throw it all back at him, it made him wonder about himself. Maybe she was just mad at him for trying to explain Peregrine. She would like Peregrine if she let herself, he was sure of it. But then again, maybe his ideas just weren't that good, at least by comparison with humans. That thought left him pretty low, but he finished redrawing the diagrams and even got some new ideas. Maybe he should get some more silk paper. Peregrine stopped by and persuaded him to go into town. Jacques Ramafan had made up a dozen explanations why he wasn't participating in the sessions with Johanna anymore. He tried out 2 or 3 as he and Peregrine descended Castle Street toward the harbor. After a minute or two, his friend turned to head back. "It's okay, Scriber. When you feel like it, we'd like to have you back." Scriber had always been a very good judge of attitude. In particular, he could tell when he was being patronized. He must have scowled a little, because Peregrine went on. "I mean it. Even Woodcarver has been asking about you. She likes your ideas." Comforting lies or not, Scriber brightened. "Really?" The Woodcarver of today was a sad case, but the Woodcarver of the history books was one of Jacques Ramafan's great heroes. "No one's mad at me?" "Well, Vendacious is a bit peeved. Being responsible for the 2-legs' safety makes him very nervous. But you only tried something we've all wanted to do."
"Yeah."
Even if there had been no data set, even if Johanna Olschendott had not come from the stars, she would still be the most fascinating creature in the world. A pack-equivalent mind and a single body. You could walk right up to her. You could touch her without the least confusion. It was frightening at first, but all of them quickly felt the attraction. For Pax, closeness had always meant mindlessness, whether for sex or battle. Imagine being able to sit by the fire with a friend and carry on an intelligent conversation. Woodcarver had a theory that the two-legs civilization might be innately more effective than any packish one, that collaboration was so easy for humans that they learned and built much faster than Pax could. The only problem with that theory was Johanna Olschendott. If Johanna was a normal human, it was a surprise that the race could cooperate on anything. Sometimes she was friendly, usually in the sessions with Woodcarver. She seemed to realize that Woodcarver was frail and failing. More often, she was patronizing, sarcastic, and seemed to think the best they could do for her, insulting. And sometimes, she was like last night.
"How goes it with Dataset?"
he asked after a moment.
Peregrine shrugged. "About like before. Both Woodcarver and I can read Somnorsh pretty well now. Johanna has taught us, me via Woodcarver, I should say, how to use most of Dataset's powers. There's so much there that will change the world. But for now, we have to concentrate on making gunpowder and cannons. It's that, the actual doing, that's going slow."
Scriber nodded knowingly. That had been the central problem in his life, too.
"Anyway, if we can do all that by midsummer, maybe we can face Flenser's army and recapture the flying house before next winter."
Peregrine made a grin that stretched from face to face.
"And then, my friend, Johanna can call her people for rescue. And we'll have all our lives to study the outsiders. I made pilgrimage to worlds around other stars."
It was an idea they had talked of before. Peregrine had thought of it even before Scriber. They turned off Castle Street onto Edge Row. Scriber was feeling more enthusiastic about visiting the stationers. There must be some way he could help. He looked around with an interest that had been lacking the last few days. Woodcarver's was a fair-sized city, almost as big as Rangathir. Maybe 20,000 packs lived within its walls and in the homes immediately around. This day was a bit colder than the last few, but it wasn't raining. A cold, clean wind swept the market street, carrying faint smells of mildew and sewage, of spices and fresh-sawn wood. Dark clouds hung low, misting the hills around the harbor. Spring was definitely in the air. Scriber kicked playfully at the slush along the curb. Peregrine led them to a side street. The place was jammed, strangers getting as close as 7 or 8 yards. The stalls at the stationers were even worse. The felt dividers weren't that thick, and there seemed to be more interest in literature at Woodcarver's than any place Scriber had ever been. He could hardly hear himself think as he haggled with the stationer. The merchant sat on a raised platform with thick padding. He wasn't much bothered by the racket. Scriber kept his heads close together, concentrating on the prices and the product. From his past life, he was pretty good at this sort of thing. Eventually, he got his paper, and at a decent price.
"Let's go back on Pack Wheel," he said.
That was the long way through the center of the market. When he was in a good mood, Scriber rather liked crowds. He was a great student of people. Woodcarver's was not as cosmopolitan as some cities by the Long Lakes, but there were traders from all over. He saw several packs wearing the bonnets of a tropic collective. At one intersection, a red jacket from East Home was chatting cozily with a labor master. When packs came this close, and in these numbers, the world seemed to teeter on the edge of a choir. Each person hung near to himself, trying to keep his own thoughts intact. It was hard to walk without stumbling over your own feet, and sometimes the background thought sounds would surge, a moment where several packs would somehow synchronize. Your consciousness wavered, and for an instant, you were one with many, a super pack that might be a god. Jacques Ramaphan shivered. That was the essential attraction of the tropics. The crowds there were mobs, vast group minds as stupid as they were ecstatic. If the stories were true, some of the southern cities were non-stop orgies. They had roamed the marketplace almost an hour when it hit him. Scriber shook his head abruptly. He turned and walked in lockstep off pack wheel and up a side street. Peregrine followed.
"Is the crowd too much?" he asked. "I just had an idea," said Scriber.
That wasn't unusual in a close crowd, but this was a very interesting idea. He said nothing more for several minutes. The side street climbed steeply, then jinked back and forth across Castle Hill. The upslope side was lined with burghers' homes. On the harbor side, they were looking out over the steep tile roofs of houses on the next switchback down. These were large homes, elegant with rosemaling. Only a few had shops on the street. Scriber slowed down and spread out enough that he wasn't stepping on himself. He saw now that he'd been quite wrong in trying to contribute creative expertise to Johanna. There was simply too much invention in Dataset. But they still needed him. Johanna most of all. The problem was they didn't know it yet. Finally, he said to Peregrine,
"Haven't you wondered that the Flenserists haven't attacked the city? You and I embarrassed the lords of Hidden Island more than ever in their history. We hold the keys to their total defeat."
Johanna and Dataset. Peregrine hesitated.
I assumed their army wasn't up to it. I should think if they were, they'd have knocked over woodcarvers long before.
Perhaps they could, but at great cost. Now the cost is worth it.
He gave Peregrine a serious look.
No, I think there's another reason. They have the flying house, but they have no idea how to use it. They want Johanna back alive, almost as much as they want to kill all of us.
Peregrine made a bitter sound.
If Steele hadn't been so eager to massacre everything on two legs, he could have had all sorts of help.
True, and the Flenserists must know that. I'll bet they've always had spies among the townspeople here. But now, more than ever. Did you see all the East Home packs?
East Home was a hotbed of Flenser sentiment. Even before the movement, they had been a hard folk, routinely sacrificing pups that didn't meet their brood standards.
One, anyway, talking to a labor master.
Right. Who knows what's coming in disguised as special purpose packs? I'd bet my life they're planning to kidnap Johanna. If they guess what we're planning with her, they may just try to kill her. Don't you see? We must alert Woodcarver and Vindacious, organize the people to watch for spies.
You noticed all this on one walk through Pack Wheel?
There was wonder or disbelief in his voice. Scriber couldn't tell which.
Well, no. The inspiration wasn't anything so direct, but it stands to reason, don't you think?
They walked in silence for several minutes. Up here the wind was stronger and the view more spectacular. Where there wasn't the sea, forests spread endless gray and green. Everything was very peaceful. Because this was a game of stealth. Fortunately, Scriber had a talent for such games. After all, hadn't it been the very political police of the Republic who commissioned him to survey Hidden Island? It had taken him several 10 days of patient persuasion, but in the end they had been enthusiastic. "Anything you can discover, we would be most happy to review." Those were their exact words. Peregrine waffled around the road, seemingly very taken aback by Scriber's suggestion. Finally, he said,
"I think there is something you should know, something that must remain an absolute secret."
"Upon my soul, Peregrine, I do not blab secrets."
Scriber was a little hurt at the lack of trust and also that the other might have discovered something he had not. The second should not bother him. He had guessed that Peregrine and Woodcarver were into each other. No telling what she might have confided or what might have leaked across.
"Okay. You've tripped onto something that should not be noised about. You know, Vendacious is in charge of Woodcarver's security."
"Of course.
That was implicit in the office of Lord Chamberlain. And considering the number of outsiders wandering around, I can't say he's doing a very good job. In fact, he's doing a marvelously effective job. Vendacious has agents right at the top of Hidden Island, one step removed from Lord Steele himself. Scriber felt his eyes widening. Yes, you understand what that means. Through Vendacious, Woodcarver knows for a certainty everything their High Council plans. With clever misinformation, we can lead the Flintzerists around like frog hens at a thinning. Next to Johanna herself, this may be Woodcarver's greatest advantage.
I had no idea.
So the incompetent local security is just a cover?
Not exactly. It's supposed to look solid and intelligent, but with just enough exploitable weakness so the movement will postpone a frontal attack in favor of espionage. He smiled. I think Vendacious will be very taken aback to hear your critique.
Scriber gave a weak laugh. He was flattered and boggled at the same time. Vendacious must count as the greatest spymaster of the age, yet he, Scriber, Jacques Ramafan, had almost seen through him. Scriber was mostly quiet the rest of the way back to the castle, but his mind was racing. Peregrine was more right than he knew. Secrecy was vital. Unnecessary discussion, even between old friends, must be avoided. Yes, he would offer his services to Vendacious. His new role might keep him in the background, but it was where he could make the greatest contribution, and eventually even Johanna would see how helpful he could be. Down the Well of the Night. Even when Ravna wasn't looking out the windows, that was the image in her mind. Relay was far off the galactic disk. The OOB was descending toward that disk and ever deeper into slowness. But they had escaped. The OOB was crippled, but they had left Relay at almost 50 light-years per hour. Each hour they were deeper in the beyond, and the computation time for the micro-jumps increased, and their pseudo-velocity declined. Nevertheless, they were making progress. They were deep into the middle of the beyond now, and there was no sign of pursuit. Thank goodness. Whatever had brought the blight to Relay, it had not been a specific knowledge of the OOB. Hope. Ravna felt it growing in her. The ship's medical automation claimed that Fom Nguyen could be saved, that there was brain activity. The terrible wounds in his back had been Oldwin's implants, organic machinery that had made Fom close-linked to Relay's local network, and thence to the power above. And when that power died, somehow the gear in Fom became a putrescent ruin. So Fom the person should still exist. Pray he still exists. The surgeon thought it would be 3 days before his back was healed enough to attempt resuscitation. In the meantime, Ravna was learning more about the apocalypse that had swept over her. Every 20 hours, Greenstalk and Blueshell jigged the ship sideways a few light-years into some major trunk line of the known net to soak up the news. It was a common practice on any voyage of more than a few days. An easy way for merchants and travelers to keep track of events that might affect their success at voyage's end. According to the news, that is, according to the vast majority of the opinions expressed, the fall of Relay was complete. O Gronder, O Egravan and Sarali, are you dead or owned now? Parts of the known net were temporarily out of contact. Some of the extra-galactic links might not be replaced for years. For the first time in millennia, a power was known to have been murdered. There were tens of thousands of claims about the motive for the attack and tens of thousands of predictions about what would happen next. Ravna had the ship filter the avalanche, trying to distill the essence of the speculations. The one coming from Straumly Realm itself made as much sense as any. The perversion's thralls gloated solemnly about the new era, the marriage of a transcendent being with races of the beyond. If Relay could be destroyed, if a power could be murdered, then nothing could stop the spread of victory. Some senders thought that Relay was the ancestral target of whatever had perverted Strownly Realm. Maybe the attack was just the tail end of some long-ago war, a misbegotten tragedy for the descendants of forgotten races. If so, then the thralls at Strownly Realm might just wither away and the original human culture there reappear. A number of items suggested that the attack had been aimed at stealing Relay's archives, but only one or two claimed that the Blight sought to recover an artifact or prevent the Relayers from recovering one. Those assertions came from chronic theorizers, the sort of civilizations that get surcharged by newsgroup automation. Nevertheless, Ravna looked through those messages carefully. None of them suggested an artifact in the low beyond. If anything, they claimed the Blight was searching for something in the high beyond or low transcend. There was network traffic coming out of the Blight. Its high protocol messages were rejected by all but the suicidal, and no one was getting paid to forward anything. Yet horror and curiosity spread some of the messages far. There was the Blighter video, almost 400 seconds of pansensual data with no compression. That incredibly expensive message might be the most forwarded hog in all net history. Blue Shell held the OOB on the trunk path for nearly 2 days to receive the whole thing. The perversion's thralls all appeared to be human. About half the news items coming out of the realm were video evocations, though none this long. All showed human speakers. Ravna watched the big one again and again. She even recognized the speaker. Ervin Nilschendot had been Strownly Realm's champion trail runner. He had no title now and probably no name. Nilschendot spoke from an office that might have been a garden. If Ravna stepped to the side of the image, she could see over his shoulder to ground level. The city there looked like the Strownly Main of record. Years ago, Ravna and her sister had dreamed about that city, the heart of mankind's adventure into the transcend. The central square had been a replica of the Field of Princesses on Nuyora, and the immigration advertising claimed that no matter how far the Straumers went, the fountain in the field would always flow, would always show their loyalty to humankind's beginnings. There was no fountain now, and Ravna felt deadness behind Nilschendot's gaze.
"This one speaks as the power that helps," said the erstwhile hero. "I want all to see what I can do for even a third-rate civilization. Look upon my helping."
The viewpoint swung skywards. It was sunset, and the rank-de-grav structures hung against the light, megameter upon megameter. It was a more grandiose use of the agrav material than Ravna had ever seen, even on the docks. Certainly no world in the middle beyond could ever afford to import the material in such quantities.
"What you see above me is just the work barracks for the construction that I will soon begin in the Strownly system. When complete, 5 star systems will be a single habitat, their planets and excess stellar mass distributed to support life and technology as never before seen at these depths, and as rarely seen in the transcend itself."
The view returned to Nilschendot, a single human, mouthpiece for a god.
"Some of you may rebel against the idea of dedicating yourselves to me. In the long run, it does not matter. The symbiosis of my power with the hands of races in the beyond is more than any can resist. But I speak now to diminish your fear. What you see in Strownly Realm is as much a joy as a wonder. Never again will races in the beyond be left behind by transcendence. Those who join me, and all will join eventually, will be part of the power. You will have access to imports from across the top and lower transcend. You will reproduce beyond the limits your own technology could sustain. You will absorb all that oppose me. You will bring the new stability."
The third or fourth time she watched the item, Ravna tried to ignore the words, concentrate on Nilschendot's expression, comparing it to speeches she had in her personal data set. There was a difference. It wasn't her imagination.
the creature she watched was soul-dead. Somehow, the blight didn't care that that was obvious. Maybe it wasn't obvious except to human viewers, and they were a vanishingly small fraction of the audience. The viewpoint closed in on Nilshin Dot's ordinary dark face, his ordinary violet eyes. Some of you may wonder how all this is possible, and why billions of years of anarchy have passed without such help from a power. The answer is complex. Like many sensible developments, this one has a high threshold. On one side of that threshold, the development appears impossibly unlikely. On the other, inevitable. The symbiosis of the helping depends on efficient, high bandwidth communication between myself and the beings I help. Creatures such as the one now speaking my words must respond as quickly and faithfully as a hand or a mouth. Their eyes and ears must report across light years. This has been hard to achieve, especially since the system must essentially be in place before it can function. But now that the symbiosis exists, progress will come much faster. Almost any race can be modified to receive help. Almost any race can be modified. The words came from a familiar face and in Ravna's birth language, but the origin was monstrously far away. There was plenty of analysis. A whole news group had been formed. Threat of the Blight was spawned from Threats Group, Homo Sapiens Interest Group, and Close-Coupled Automation. These days it was busier than any five other groups. In this part of the galaxy, a significant fraction of all message traffic belonged to the new group. More bits were sent analyzing poor Irvin Nilshendot's mouthing than had been in the original. Judging from the flames and contradictions, the signal-to-noise ratio was very low. Crypto Zero, as received by OOB, shipboard ad hoc. Language path, Aquilaron to Trisqualine, SJK units. From Korvark University, claimed to be habitat-based university in the middle beyond. Subject, Blighter video. Summary, the message shows fraud. Distribution, War Trackers Interest Group, Where Are They Now, Interest Group, Threat of the Blight. Date, 7.06 days since fall of relay. Text of message. It's obvious that this helper is a fraud. We've researched the matter carefully. Though he is not named, the speaker is a high official in the former Straumli regime. Now why, if the helper simply runs the humans as teleoperated robots, why is the earlier social structure preserved? The answer should be clear to any idiot. The helper does not have the power to teleoperate large numbers of sentients. Evidently, the fall of Straumli realm consisted of taking over key elements in that civilization's power structure. It's business as usual for the rest of the race. Our conclusion, this helper symbiosis is just another messianic religion, another screwball empire excusing its excesses and attempting to trick those it cannot directly coerce. Don't be fooled. Crypto Zero, as received by OOB, shipboard ad hoc. Language path, Optima to Aquilaron to Trisqualine, SJK units. From Society for Rational Investigation, probably a single system in middle beyond, 5,700 light-years anti-spinward of Chandra K. Subject, Blighter Video Thread, Korvark University 1. Key phrases, probable obscenity, waste of our valuable time. Distribution, Society for Rational Network Management, Threat of the Blight. Date, 7.91 days since fall of relay. Text of message. Who is a fool? Probable obscenity. Idiots who don't follow all the threads in developing news should not waste my precious ears with their clear obscenity garbage. So you think the helper symbiosis is a fraud of Straumli realm? And what do you think caused the fall of relay? in case your head is totally stuck up your rear, probable insult, there was a power allied with Relay. That power is now dead. You think maybe it just committed suicide? Look it up, Flathead. Probable insult. No power has ever fallen to anything from the beyond. The blight is something new and interesting. I think it's time that, obscenity, jerks like Korvark University stick to the noise groups and let the rest of us have some intelligent discussion. And some messages were patent nonsense. One thing about the net, the multiple automatic translations often disguised the fundamental alienness of participants. Behind the chatty colloquial postings, there were faraway realms, so misted by distance and difference that communication was impossible, even though it might take a while to realize the fact. For instance, Crypto Zero, as received by OOB Shipboard Ad Hoc, Language Path, Arbwith to Trade 24 to Chairgwalin, to Trisqualine, SJK units. From Twirlip of the Mist, perhaps an organization of cloud flyers in a single Jovian system. Very sparse priors. Subject. Blighter video thread. Key phrases. Hexapodia as the key insight. Distribution. Threat of the blight. Date. 8.68 days since fall of Relay. Text of message. I haven't had a chance to see the famous video from Stroumly Realm except as an evocation. My only gateway onto the net is very expensive. Is it true that humans have six legs? I wasn't sure from the evocation. If these humans have three pairs of legs, then I think there is an easy explanation for... Hexapodia? Six legs? Three pairs of legs? Probably none of these translations was close to what the bewildered creature of Twirlip had in its mind. Ravna didn't read any more of that posting. Crypto Zero, as received by OOB Shipboard Ad Hoc, Language Path, Tresqualine SJK Units, from Hans. No references prior to the fall of Relay. No probable source. This is someone being very cautious. Subject, Blighter Video Thread, Korvark University 1. Distribution, War Tracker's Interest Group, Threat of the Blight. Date, 8.68 days since fall of Relay. Text of message. Korvark University thinks the blight is a fraud because elements of the former regime have survived on Straum. There is another explanation. Suppose the blight is indeed a power, and that its claims of effective symbiosis are generally true. That means that the creature being helped is no more than a remotely controlled device, his brain simply a local processor supporting the communication. Would you want to be helped like that? My question isn't completely rhetorical. The readership is wide enough that there may be some of you who would answer yes. However, the vast majority of naturally evolved sentient beings would be revolted by the notion. Surely the blight knows this. My guess is that the blight is not a fraud, but that the notion of surviving culture in Stroumly Realm is. Subtly, the blight wants to convey the impression that only some are directly enslaved, that cultures as a whole will survive. Combine that with Blight's claim that not all races can be teleoperated. We're left with the subtext that immense riches are available to races that associate themselves with this power. Yet the biological and intellectual imperatives of these races will still be satisfied. So the question remains, just how thorough is the blight's control over conquered races? I don't know. There may not be any self-aware minds left in the blights beyond, only billions of teleoperated devices. One thing is clear. The blight needs something from us that it cannot yet take. And so it went. Tens of thousands of messages, hundreds of points of view. It was not called the net of a million lies for nothing. Ravna talked with Blueshell and Greenstalk about it every day, trying to put it all together, trying to decide which interpretation to believe. The writers knew humans well, but even they weren't sure of the deadness in Irvin Neilson Dot's face. And Greenstalk knew humans well enough to see that there was no answer that would comfort Ravna. She rolled back and forth in front of the news window, finally reached to Frondot to touch the human.
Perhaps Sir Tham can say once he is well.
Blueshell was bustling clinical.
If you're right, that means that somehow the Blight doesn't care what humans and those close to humans know. In a way, that makes sense, but...
His voter buzzed absent-mindedly for a moment.
I mistrust this message. 400 seconds of broad band, so rich that it gives full sense imagery for many different races. That's an enormous amount of information and no compression whatsoever. Maybe it's sweetened bait, forwarded by us poor beyonders back to our every nest.
That suspicion had been in the news, too. But there were no obvious patterns in the message and nothing that talked to network automation. Such subtle poison might work at the top of the beyond, but not down here. And that left a simpler explanation, one that would make perfect sense even on Nuyora or Old Earth. The video masked a message to agents already in place. Vendacious was well known to the people of Woodcarvers, but for mostly the wrong reasons. He was about a century old, the fusion offspring of Woodcarver on two of his strategists. In his early decades, Vendacious had managed the city's wood mills. Along the way, he devised some clever improvements on the water wheel. Vendacious had had his own romantic entanglements, mostly with politicians and speechmakers. More and more, his replacement members inclined him toward public life. For the last 30 years, he had been one of the strongest voices on Woodcarver's Council, for the last 10, Lord Chamberlain. In both roles, he had stood for the guilds and for fair trade. There were rumors that if Woodcarver should ever abdicate or wholly die, Vendacious would be the next Lord of Council. Many thought that might be the best that could be made of such a disaster, though Vendacious's pompous speeches were already the bane of the Council.
End of Side 6. To continue, change Side Selector switch and turn the cassette over.